welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, December 1. In the weather story, following a backward temperature trend. So far this fall season, we have seen 9 days in Cedar Rapids with a high temperature below 40 degrees. That's pretty normal. On average, we experience 9 to 10 such days per autumn through the end of November. The order of when we recorded those highs comes off as a little wacky. Typically, November averages 9 days below 40 for highs, and October gets one every other year. This year, though, it was a little backwards. October notched 5 of those days, and November reached only 4. This reversal has only happened in one other year on record, which stretches back to 1893. In 1913, there were 4 days in October with these cold nights, but only 2 in November. Today in Cedar Rapids, we're looking for a high of 37 and a low of 20, 38 and 21 in Iowa City. The normal high for today is 39 and the normal low is 23. Partly cloudy into the next few days with highs in the low 40s or the high 30s. And we're in the waning gibbous moon phase. Sunset tonight is at 4:36. Sunrise tomorrow at 7:16, giving us 9 hours and 20 minutes of daylight. Moving to the front page of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette, November proves the deadliest for the virus. This story's by Gage Miskimen. By far, November has proven to be the deadliest month ever in Iowa for COVID-19, claiming 688 lives and ranking the state among the nation's grimmest when adjusted for population. Worse, November's deadly record comes on top of October's deadly record and far outpaces it. October's 372 COVID-19 deaths was a peak until November's toll nearly doubled it, according to databases maintained by the Washington Post and the New York Times. Iowa currently ranks 6th worst in the nation for its average rate of deaths per 100,000 people. November also brought Iowa's highest number of confirmed cases in a month since the pandemic began here in March. The state added 101,574 cases, almost doubling in just 1 month the cases accumulated in nearly 7 months prior, bringing the total so far to 229,019. As with deaths, the month with the second highest number of confirmed cases was October, and again, the record then was far lower at 38,883 for the month. So, while COVID-19 worsened in October, it mushroomed exponentially in November. For the final day of the month, Iowa confirmed 28 more COVID-19 deaths Monday morning, bringing the total since last spring to 2,403 Iowans. Woodbury County reported 5 of those deaths. Clinton County had 4 and Warren County had 3. Counties reporting 2 deaths each were Appanoose, Polk, and Webster, and counties with 1 death each were Blackhawk, Jasper, Johnson, Kossuth, Lynn, O'Brien, Scott, Story, Wapello, and Winnesheek. A total of 165 Lynn County residents and 37 Johnson County residents have died since the start of the pandemic. State hospitalizations continue to be high but dipped Monday for the 6th day in a row. The number of people in Iowa hospitals being treated for the disease declined from 1,175 to 1,162. Patients in intensive care dropped from 235 to 224. And patients on ventilators inched down from 151 to 147. Iowa reported 1,222 new cases of COVID-19 in the 24-hour period ending at 11 a.m. Monday, according to data analyzed by the Gazette, a smaller daily tally than has been seen for much of November. But the number of tests being run has also declined recently. 3 of the last 4 days have seen less than 5,000 test results each. Monday had 3,065 test results run in the 24-hour period. All 5 test Iowa sites and the state hygienic lab were closed on Thanksgiving Day. Of the new cases, Lynn County added 119 on a 7-day average of 160 new cases a day. Johnson County added 63 and a 7-day average of 81 cases a day. Of the new cases reported Monday, 196 were of school-age children up to 17 years old. No new cases were reported for adults in the education occupation category. Across the state, outbreaks were reported at 156 long-term care facilities, an increase of 3 in a day. In the facilities, there were 4,998 individuals with the virus as of Monday, an increase of 200 since Sunday. There was also one new death for a total of 1,063 deaths reported so far among the facilities. Locally, Hiawatha Care Center went from 102 to 103 cases with 76 recoveries. West Ridge Care Center increased from 21 to 28 cases with no recoveries. And the Gardens of Cedar Rapids went from 6 to 8 cases and no recoveries, according to data from the Iowa Department of Public Health. Lantern Park Specialty Care in Coralville was added Monday to the state's outbreak list with just one case reported. The state did not explain why the facility was added to the list with just one case, but the most recent federal records show Lantern Park Specialty Care reported several cases among residents and staff to the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for the week ending November 15. And in another front page story, it's Miller Meeks by just 6 votes. This story's by Tom Barton for the Quad City Times. Nearly 4 weeks after the election, Iowa's canvassing board Monday declared Republican Marionette Miller Meeks the winner of the state's second congressional district race by just 6 votes, the closest congressional race in the country, and one that flips a seat held by a Democrat for 14 years. The state board certified results for the race following vote recounts conducted in all 24 counties within the southeastern Iowa district, which includes Iowa City, Davenport, and Burlington. Miller Meeks, a state senator and ophthalmologist from Ottumwa, edged out Democrat and former state senator Rita Hart of Wheatland with 196,964 votes to Hart's 196,958, results showed. Once again, I want to express my heartfelt gratitude to the voters of IA02, Miller Meeks tweeted after the canvassing board certified the results. I will never quit fighting for you and your opportunity at the American Dream. Let's get to work. There still is a possibility of legal challenges brought by the Hart campaign, which would set in motion a proceeding before a judicial panel. The Associated Press is expected to wait until after all legal appeals are exhausted before declaring a winner. The Hart campaign has not said if it will mount a legal challenge, but issued a statement Monday saying that over the next few days, we will outline our next steps in this process to ensure that all Iowans' voices are heard. The Hart campaign has asserted the Miller Meeks campaign sought to keep legitimate votes from being counted, pushing to disqualify and limit the number of Iowans whose votes are counted. Recount boards may consider only ballots considered on election night per state law. That means that even if a recount board were aware of ballots unlawfully excluded from the initial count, it could not include those ballots in a recount, according to Hart's campaign. That issue would have to go to an election contest. Miller Meeks' 6-vote lead represents the slimmest margin in any congressional race since 1984, when Indiana's 8th district was decided by 4 votes. The margin is the smallest of any congressional race in Iowa since 1916. Republican George C. Scott won by 4 votes over Democrat T.J. Steele to represent Iowa's then 11th congressional district, after a series of recounts whittled his margin from an initial 131-vote lead. Since then, only 3 Iowa congressional races have come within 500 votes, said Leo Landis, curator for the State Historical Society of Iowa. This race reinforces that every single vote can make a difference and hopefully sends a message about how important it is to be a voter, Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate said. The state canvassing board is made up of Pate, a Republican, as well as Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, Republican Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig, Democratic State Auditor Rod Sand, and Democratic State Treasurer Michael Fitzgerald. The full state canvass is available on the Iowa Secretary of State's website. The race's outcome narrowed considerably since election night when Miller Meeks held a 282-vote lead over Hart. Before the recount began, Miller Meeks' lead had narrowed to 47 after late-arriving mail-in, absentee, and provisional ballots were counted, and precinct reporting errors were corrected in Jasper and Lucas counties. Earlier Monday, the Scott County Board of Supervisors voted unanimously to certify the results of that county's recount ahead of the State Canvassing Board meeting. That came despite an unexplained discrepancy in the absentee ballot total, with the recount board tallying 131 more absentee ballot than Scott County Auditor's post-election canvass. Rather than conduct the full machine recount of absentee ballots requested by Scott County Auditor Roxanne Moritz, the board decided, 2-1, over the objection of Miller Meeks' campaign to adjourn last week, leaving the unexplained discrepancy. The other two members of the board, including the Hart campaign's representative, argued it was beyond their scope to conduct an audit. They said their task was not to reconcile the recount and initial county canvass of votes, but to conduct the recount in the fairest, most reasonable, and transparent process available, which they argue they did, and that any discrepancy should be resolved through a legal contest. Moritz said Iowa code prevents her from conducting an administrative machine count to verify the discrepancy, noting that all votes were counted. There are more ballots than votes. If a candidate is disappointed in the recount, their options are to file a contest, Moritz told county supervisors. No definitive explanation has been given for the ballot discrepancy. However, one plausible explanation, according to Moritz, is that absentee ballots that were to be rerun through a different tabulation machine on election day, after another tabulator broke, were mistakenly placed in a box of already counted absentee ballots. Scott County Supervisors John Maxwell and Ken Croken, while troubled by the discrepancy, said their hands were tied. Certifying doesn't mean we are good with this outcome, Croken said. It means we would like the process to move forward expeditiously. Scott County Attorney Michael Walton on Monday said Iowa Code states county supervisors shall certify the recount board's results. I don't see really any alternative at this point, Walton said. Yes, it's not perfect. Yes, there are questions that one side or the other may want answered through a contest, but I don't see any point in the Board of Supervisors not following the law at this point and thereby creating some sort of litigation at this level and possibly interfering with the completion of the Iowa certification of its elections. Jeff Thompson with the Iowa Attorney General's Office also emphasized Monday that the duty and obligation of the State Canvassing Board was to receive the returns provided by Pate's office and administratively determine whether the canvass was correct and declare the result. To the extent that there is a challenge or a contest of a particular result, that is covered in the next step and another statutory scheme, Thompson said. Hart has 2 days to contest the state-certified results per Iowa code, throwing the race to a 5-member judicial tribunal presided over by the Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court. Hart would be required to post a bond to cover the cost of the challenge if unsuccessful. A 5-judge panel would be expected to rule by December 8th on which candidate is entitled to hold the office, Moritz said. Hart's campaign also has the option of requesting that the Democrat-controlled U.S. House investigate the contested election, with Congress as the final arbiter, Moritz said. Congress has intervened in tight races, but rarely, according to both Moritz and the Associated Press. The winner replaces Democratic U.S. Representative Dave Loebsack, who is retiring after holding the seat for 7 terms. Miller Meeks lost 3 previous runs against Loebsack in 2008, 2010, and 2014. It is the honor of a lifetime to be elected to serve the people of eastern and southern Iowa, Miller Meeks, an Army veteran and former state public health director, said in a statement Saturday, declaring victory then after Clinton County, the last county in the district, had completed its recount. Iowans are tenacious, optimistic, and hardworking, and I will take those same attributes to Washington, D.C. on their behalf. On the front page, classrooms are shuttered, but thousands stay in dorms. This by Vanessa Miller. Thousands of students remain in residence halls across Iowa's three public universities, even though Iowa State and the University of Northern Iowa last week wrapped up their fall semesters early due to COVID-19, and the University of Iowa has moved classes online for the rest of the term. The UI, which ends its fall semester December 18 on Monday, reported 2,053 residence hall students say they plan to remain in university housing during the virtual instruction period. For context, that's approximately 45% of our residence hall population, according to UI spokesman Haley Bruce. The UI's goal of moving courses online after Thanksgiving was to discourage a return to campus after high-risk holiday travel. ISU and UNI addressed that concern by starting and ending their semesters early. All three of Iowa's public universities are keeping on-campus housing open through the extended winter break, during which each is offering courses for students looking to make up for lost time or get ahead before the spring semester later than usual start, January 25. The universities also are keeping dining facilities running this winter and maintaining space in their halls for students needing to isolate or quarantine after testing positive for COVID-19 or coming into close contact with someone who has it. ISU, which ended its fall semester Wednesday and graduated 2,171 students over the weekend, on Monday reported 12 students with COVID-19 are using residence hall rooms to isolate, and another 5 who are exposed are quarantining. UNI, after also ending its fall semester Wednesday, reported 24 students in dorm rooms, quarantine, and 7 in isolation. UI is reporting just 1 residence hall student in quarantine and 2 in isolation. UNI, which has been under its residence hall capacity of 3,770, typically sees 10% to 15% of its dorm students stay over break, according to spokesman Steve Schmadeke. This year is no exception, he said. ISU is keeping its halls open for the full break, but requiring those wanting to stay between December 20 and January 6 to sign up by December 19. Sign-up is only required during this time frame and for residence halls that generally close over break, ISU spokeswoman Angie Hunt said. UI students must apply for winter housing, with deadlines dependent on when a student wants to be there. To the community page, the Iowa Today page, a shooting leaves one dead. In Cedar Rapids, a person was found dead late Monday morning when police arrived at the scene of a shooting in northwest Cedar Rapids. Police were dispatched at 10:54 a.m. to the 400 block of F Avenue Northwest for a shots fired incident, according to a news release from the Cedar Rapids Police Department. Upon arrival, police found a deceased victim. A person of interest was being questioned, and police remained on the scene. Police think it was a targeted incident based on preliminary investigation. There is an active investigation ongoing. Police Cedar Rapids police cruisers are stationed outside a home Monday in the 400 block of F Avenue Northwest following that shooting. Police were called just before 11 a.m. Monday and found a deceased person when they arrived. And in another Iowa Today story by Trish Mahaffey, former prisoner is arrested in the Cedar Rapids shooting. A 23-year-old Cedar Rapids felon released early for drug robbery and firearms prison sentence was arrested again Sunday in a shooting incident on the southwest side. Demontre Rayshon Redmond faces charges of felon in possession of a firearm, reckless use of a firearm with property damage, and carrying a concealed weapon. Cedar Rapids police said officers responded at 11:41 a.m. Sunday to the 1500 block of Hamilton Street Southwest for a disturbance. Those who called 911 reported hearing a loud bang and seeing several people run from the scene. Witnesses told police a person with a firearm ran inside a residence in the 100 block of 15th Avenue Southwest. They also indicated that person fired several rounds in the alley between First Street and Hamilton Street Southwest. Officers found several shell casings in the alleyway, police said, as well as damage to a garage and vehicle from the shooting. Officers made contact with a resident of the home that the shooter and others had entered and were able to get the individuals to come out, police said. A handgun was found in the basement where police said the individuals attempted to hide. No injuries were reported, and Redmond was arrested. He was released from prison in January after a 2015 drug robbery. Redmond, who was 17 at the time of the crime, pleaded in 2016 to amended charges of second-degree robbery, reckless use of a firearm causing bodily injury, and trafficking in stolen firearms. He originally was charged with attempted murder, but that charge was dismissed. Redmond, during a plea hearing, admitted to robbing and assaulting an 18-year-old during a drug deal in the parking lot of St. Jude Catholic Church on January 27, 2015. He also admitted to discharging a gun, but said he didn't intentionally shoot the teen. Redmond also admitted to possessing a 9mm stolen handgun. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison, but served only about 3 years, according to court records. Another story, this by Aaron Jordan, a second Iowa prison officer dies from the virus. A second Iowa prison staff member has died from COVID-19, according to AFSCME Council 61, which represents correctional workers. President Danny Holman was notified Saturday night a correctional officer from the Clarinda Correctional Facility had died from COVID-19. Correctional officers clearly right now are on the front line with all the outbreaks that we have inside our facilities, Holman said in an interview Monday. The Iowa Department of Corrections did not immediately respond to the Gazette's request to confirm the information. The agency's COVID-19 website, last updated Saturday morning, lists just one staff death, the November 16 death of a male officer at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women in Mitchellville. The website says 10 people incarcerated in Iowa's prisons have died from COVID-19. More than 280 offenders were COVID positive as of Saturday, and 3,002 had recovered, while 92 staff were COVID positive and 411 had recovered. Moving to the Insight page today, the guest editorial is a reprint from the New York Daily News. The Supreme Court got it wrong. The unsigned opinion by the nation's highest court got it wrong, insisting that restrictions placed on religious gatherings imposed by Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York's COVID hotspots must be nullified, for they violate the First Amendment. The dissent by the Bronx's Sonia Sotomayor got it right. The rules capping gatherings at 10 people or less are actually more generous for faith-based institutions than for any other type. New York treats houses of worship far more favorably than their secular comparators. How on earth can that be an offense to the guaranteed freedom to exercise religion? The majority has no answer. Nor do they have a compelling reply to Chief Justice John Roberts' dissent, which points out that since churches and synagogues filed their challenges to New York's rules, the ground shifted. None of the houses of worship identified in the applications is now subject to any fixed numerical restrictions, he wrote. The governor might reinstate the restrictions, but he also might not, and it is a significant matter to override determinations made by public health officials concerning what is necessary for public safety in the midst of a deadly pandemic. In other words, there was no need to tie the hands of officials who are seeking to save lives in the midst of a public health crisis. But what's done is done. New York is no longer allowed to count to 10 in synagogues and churches. Justices Amy Coney Barrett, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, Samuel Alito, and Clarence Thomas make 5, and that's enough. In these United States, there's no higher authority on what is legal and constitutional. Going forward, Cuomo must impose restrictions on religious services and all others, keyed to the size of the given institution, similar to the way indoor dining is regulated. If lives are lost, chalk it up to bad interpretation of the free exercise clause. And again, that was a reprint from the New York Daily News. We have one community letter today. This from Steve Peterson in Cedar Rapids, and it is entitled "Problems Go Beyond Flooding at Jones Golf Course in Cedar Rapids." It was with some sadness that I read a couple weeks ago about the closure of the Jones Golf Course. While not unexpected, it still is head-shaking because of the reasons given. We all understand that the course has had flooding problems over time, but making this the sole reason for revenue problems and the primary reason for closure is misguided. The true reason for the problems, not only with Jones, but the entire golf operations, centers around the long-term mismanagement of the operations and a flawed master plan implemented in 2000. The mismanagement issues are too large to detail in this space, but center around the city of Cedar Rapids not listening to the local golfing community and instead to consultants. The repurposing option for the area should include some golf options, as the majority of the infrastructure is currently in place. These options could include improved junior programs or facilities, improved practice or teaching facilities, and possibly a different course configuration. The revenue problems will continue beyond the closure of the Jones facility, as golfers in the city have many other options for play at better rates, higher quality facilities, and the belief that the city really doesn't care about providing value to the golfing community. And again, that is signed by Steve Peterson in Cedar Rapids. And our guest column today is submitted by Ronald Bailey. Ronald is co-author of 10 Global Trends and science correspondent for Reason Magazine. The title of his article is "The World is Better, More Prosperous." The state of humanity and the world as a whole is much better and improving faster than most people think. That is what my co-author, Marion Tupi, and I demonstrate using uncontroversial but little appreciated data in our new book, 10 Global Trends Every Smart Person Should Know, and many others you will find interesting. Of course, every smart person can easily bring to mind negative trends. Man-made climate change could, if unabated, become a significant problem for humanity. And let's not forget the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. However, you can't fix what is wrong or promote progress in the world if you don't know what's actually happened. So here's the good news you may not know. Over the past 200 years, the spread of freer markets and democratic institutions has produced the Great Enrichment, during which the global economy grew 100-fold, while world population increased only 8-fold. In 1820, nearly 95% of people lived in absolute poverty, defined as subsisting in real dollar terms on less than $2 per day per person. It took 160 years for it to fall by about half to 42%. The really good news is that according to the World Bank, absolute poverty fell between 1981 and 2018 to 8.6%. Dire predictions that rising human population would inevitably result in global famines and drastically deplete natural resources have proved totally unfounded. Numerous global trends all strongly correlate with families choosing to have fewer children. Consequently, the global fertility rate has dropped from an average of 5 children per woman in 1960 to 2.4 now, and is projected to fall to 1.5 by the end of this century. Human ingenuity and innovation enabling us to produce more goods and services from less have driven down the price of natural resources and boosted record food production. Since 1980, the average real price of 50 basic food, fuel, mineral, and metal commodities fell by more than 36%. And taking into account increased purchasing power, those commodities are now nearly 65% cheaper than they were 40 years ago. Since 1960, the specter of global famine has receded as calories have increased from an average of 2,200 per person in 1961 to nearly 3,000. Farmers are producing much more food on less land, so that the world reached peak agricultural land at the turn of this century. In the meantime, the global tree canopy expanded by 865,000 square miles between 1982 and 2016, an area larger than Alaska and Montana combined. One reasonable scenario projects that nearly 1 billion more acres of farmland could be restored to nature by 2060. That's an area almost twice the size of the United States east of the Mississippi. Expanding woodlands indicates that humanity is already withdrawing from the natural world, which in turn will provide greater scope for other species to rebound and thrive. Ultimately, the global trends we document augur a world that by the end of this century will be populated with fewer and much wealthier people, living mostly in cities, with nature occupying or reoccupying the bulk of the land and sea freed up by human ingenuity. Again, that was by Ronald Bailey. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, December 1, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now let's turn to today's obituaries. Just two in the other notices today from McGregor. Olga May Corlett, age 88, died Thursday, November 26. The Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in McGregor is assisting. And in Vinton, Sharon Marlene Schulte, age 69, died Saturday, November 28. The Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton is in charge. Moving to the regular notices from Monticello, Gerald J. Muller, age 89, of Monticello, passed away Friday, November 27. At Monticello Nursing and Rehab. A private family mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, December 3 at Sacred Heart Catholic Church. The Reverend Paul Baldwin will officiate. A visitation will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 Thursday, December 3 at Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello. Again, that notice for Gerald Muller. In Esterville, Richard S., known as Dick Lund, passed away November 23 at the Avera Holy Family Hospital in Esterville at age 91 years, 2 months, and 3 days. Services for Dick will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, December 4 at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Esterville. Burial will take place at Eastside Cemetery. There will be a visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, December 3 at the Henry Olson Funeral Chapel in Esterville. That notice is for Richard Lund. From Anamosa, John Edson Andreessen, age 88, passed away Saturday, November 28, at the Clarissa Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf after a period of declining health. A private and immediate family-only funeral and graveside committal service will be held Thursday, December 3, at Cedar Memorial Cemetery in Cedar Rapids at 10 a.m. Central Time. The Reverend Wade Reddy of Wayne Zion Lutheran Church, rural Monticello, will officiate. Virtual attendance is encouraged at the Kramer Funeral Home Facebook page. That is for John Andreessen. From Cedar Rapids, Lowell Keith Baber, age 86, died Sunday, November 29th at his home after a 21-year battle with Parkinson's. Private family services will be held. Final resting place will be at St. Joseph Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. The Tian Funeral Home will be providing service to the family of Lowell Baber. In Iowa City, Carol A. Pierce, age 77, died Friday, November 27th at Mercy, Iowa City. No public services are being planned. Private interment services will take place at Memory Garden Cemetery for Carol Pierce. In Belle Plaine, Marvin Aziel DeReich, age 82, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Belle Plaine, passed away Saturday, November 28, at West Ridge Care Center, Cedar Rapids. Private family service will take place at St. Michael's Catholic Church, Belle Plaine, with burial at Oak Hill Cemetery. Again, that notice is for Marvin DeReich. In Cedar Rapids, David A. Bradley, age 81, passed away Friday, November 27, at the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown under the care of Iowa River Hospice. For additional information, contact the Mitchell Family Funeral Home. That notice is for David Bradley. From Marshalltown, Patrick Moran, age 72, of the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown, passed away on the afternoon of Wednesday, November 25. For 21 years, Patrick called IVH his home. They were the best years of his life as he found peace and joy he lacked in years prior. Graveside funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, December 2nd at Calvary Cemetery in St. Martin's section in Cascade, Iowa. Visitation will be held from 1 to 6 Tuesday at the Mitchell Family Funeral Home in Marshalltown. That notice is for Patrick Moran. In Cedar Rapids, Irene Betty Koninke, age 89, passed away Saturday, November 28, at St. Luke's Hospital from complications of COVID-19. And there is no notice of a service for Irene. From Mount Vernon, Ronald Edward Frantz, age 84, died November 29th from complications related to COVID-19 and Alzheimer's. And because of COVID-19, no service will be held at this time. A celebration of life will be announced at a later date. The Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Mount Vernon will be handling arrangements for Ronald Frantz. From Cedar Rapids, Jerry L. Morrow and Rosie R. Morrow. Celebration of life services and bury for Jerry and Rosie will be private. Public visitation will be from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. Friday, December 4, at the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids. From Iowa City, Nicole, known as Nikki Elizabeth Raitt, age 50, passed away November 28. The family will celebrate a mass of Christian burial at 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 2nd, at the Newman Catholic Student Center, with Father Jeff Belger officiating. Friends may join the family at the graveside committal service at 12:15 at St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa City following the mass. The Lensing Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements for Nikki Raitt. In Cedar Rapids, Michael E. Pernica, age 50, passed away Sunday, November 29, at his home, surrounded by family. The family has asked no services be held at this time. Cedar Memorial is in charge of arrangements for Michael Pernica. Also in Cedar Rapids, Diana K. Langeth, age 71, died Saturday, November 28, after a short illness. Services are at 1:30 p.m. Thursday at the Tien Funeral Home by Pastoral Minister Penny Ackerman. Burial will be at the Palo Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Thursday. Again, that notice is for Diana Langeth. Also in Cedar Rapids, Richard E. White Jr., age 80, died Thursday, November 26th at Mercy Medical Center. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. There will be no service or visitation at this time for Richard White. In Marion, Donald William Rosso, age 85, passed away on Saturday, November 28. He was buried in a private ceremony at Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion. Stuart Baxter Funeral Home was in charge of arrangements for Donald Rosso. In Alburnett, Saloma McWright, age 101, passed away Monday, November 30. A private family graveside service will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Cedar Memorial is in charge of arrangements for Saloma McWright. In Cedar Rapids, David C. Myers, age 82, died Sunday, November 29th at Emory Place in Robbins. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, December 3, at the Murdoch-Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Burial with military honors will follow at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. The Murdoch Funeral Home is in charge of arrangement for David Myers. In Newhall, Dennis Eldon von Ossen, age 69, passed away November 24th at the VA hospital with family by his side of heart failure after a courageous battle with cancer. A private funeral service will be held December 4 at St. John Lutheran Church, Newhall, with military honors to follow at the church cemetery. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. The Phillips Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements for Dennis von Ossen. And finally, in Van Horn, Arlene Sint, age 88, of Story City, formerly of Van Horn, died November 30th at Bethany Manor in Story City after a 9-year battle with Alzheimer's. Funeral services will be at 2 p.m. Friday, December 4 at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Van Horn, with Pastor David Lingard officiating. Interment will be at Keystone Cemetery near Keystone. And the Phillips Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements for Arlene Sint. Moving to the sports page, we have an Iowa boys basketball preview, class issues for Panthers and the Lynx. This story is by Jeff Johnson. The boys basketball season officially began Monday with some games around the state. Here's something we already know. Monticello and North Lynn will not be qualifying for the state tournament again in 2A. That's guaranteed. Book it. This is nothing COVID-related, not any indication whatsoever of the quality of their teams. They're both really good. It's just that North Lynn has dropped to 1A and Monticello is elevated to 3A. So weird how those schools on the borderline that way not only didn't stay in the same class, but each went to a different one. We knew that the current sophomore class would probably put us on the edge. We had a lot of move-ins last fall. It just put us over, Monticello coach Tim Lambert said. I guess you can approach it one of two ways. You can pout about it and get upset, or you can just take it on. I guess about between that and COVID, we've just kind of told our kids to control what we can control. You can't control the COVID thing to a degree. We can control being smart about it, and we certainly can't control the 3A thing. Last year, 2A was stacked, said North Lynn's Austin Hilmer. Now, this year, I haven't really looked much into 2A, but I know 1A is stacked. There are going to be a lot of good teams. It's going to be very deep. Then it'll be interesting to see our conference because there are going to be a lot tougher teams than in the past. It's just going to be an interesting year with everything going on, and with competition that we'll have to face night in and night out. Hilmer's got a point. Class 2A always is strong in eastern Iowa, so it's a perennial thing. But 1A this season could really be something, especially in the Tri-Rivers Conference and specifically Linn County. Springville went to state last season for the first time in 45 years and returns most of that team. Al Burnett was second in 1A at the 2019 state tourney and gets back one of the best players from that team, Hunter Caves, after a year off because of a knee injury. North Lynn coach Mike Hilmer mentioned how he thinks Tri-Rivers foes Edco and Eastern Valley are among others that will be strong. Montezuma has placed at the 1A state tourney 2 years in a row, and Meskwaki Settlement School could have its best team. Then there's Wapsie Valley, last year's 1A state champion. The Lynx won't be intimidated, though, that's for sure. They won the 2A crown in 2019 and returned to the championship game last season despite the graduation loss of Mr. Basketball Jake Hilmer, seeing a 52-game overall win streak snapped by Boyden Hull. North Lynn finished runner-up in 1A to Grandview Christian in 2018 and was third in 2017. Four of its five starters are back, the exception being first-team All-State forward Austin Miller. I think every year you have to reprove yourself, Mike Hilmer said. That's just kind of the way it is. I get tired of hearing people say, well, you don't play everybody, anybody, and all that. I don't think people realize our conference is going to be loaded again. I don't know if you can always go over who you play, because most people don't have control over who they play. It's how you play that should matter. When Jake left, a lot of people were probably thinking, well, they could, but they're probably not going to be that good, Austin Hilmer said. To get back to that final game with the competition we were facing and that dominating win against Trainer in the semifinal, I think we proved a lot. The confidence going into this season is going to be an all-time high. Monticello also has a lot of confidence, as it should. The Panthers have all five starters back in the fold from a team that gave the school its first state tourney in 60 years. Forward Justin Recker was an all-stater last season and has continued to improve his game. Lambert saying some college is going to get a steal. The coach's son Luke and nephew Connor also have lots of experience. For those interested in listening on the radio on boys basketball today, Mount Vernon's at Cedar Rapids, Xavier at 7:30 on KGYM. Back to the Iowa Today page or the community page for a bit. Here are some Eastern Iowa briefs. Freedom Festival banners to honor military veterans. The Cedar Rapids Freedom Festival is now accepting applications for the inaugural year of the Military Tribute Banner Program. The full-color banners will showcase veterans and active-duty military personnel on select light poles throughout downtown Cedar Rapids next summer. The new initiative is a wonderful way to pay tribute to a veteran or active military person in your family this holiday season by purchasing a banner in their honor. Recognizing the people who help make our freedoms possible is an integral part of the Freedom Festival. A limited number of banners are available for purchase for $250 each, which includes the design and printing of the banner, installation, maintenance, and shipping to the recipient at the end of the display period. A map of banner locations will be posted on the Freedom Festival website. To reserve a banner, click on the link at freedomfestival.com and fill out the application. Mail the completed form, along with payment by check, credit card, or Venmo, to the Cedar Rapids Freedom Festival office, 609 First Avenue Southwest, Suite 102, Cedar Rapids. Banners will be sold on a first-come, first-served basis and as payment is received. For more information, email the Events and Marketing Director, Carol Shepherd. COE's Christmas Convocation moves to a virtual format. The public can experience the COE College Christmas Convocation online at 7 p.m. today. The free event features COE's music ensembles and can be viewed at portal.stretchinternet.com/coadmin. And an icon holding biennial art auction. Bids end December 16. This is from Fairfield. The biennial Icon Art Auction is open, with bidding ending December 16. The event is the main fundraiser for the 20-year-old nonprofit arts organization known for its contemporary art gallery. The auction features 226 artworks by more than 100 artists, with new work arriving all the time. Styles range from realistic rural landscape to abstract expressionism, from impressionism to assemblage art. All bidding is online at icon-art.org, but items can be viewed online or in person by appointment at the gallery, which is at 58 North Main Street on Fairfield Square. Organizers advise visitors to study the offerings online before coming to the gallery. To view in person, call Bill Teeple at 641-919-6252. Masks are required. Bring your phone and bid there. Proceeds go to Icon operating expenses. And there's a picture of a nice gray cat in the Pet of the Week. Walter was found outdoors with other cats in his neighborhood. Those felines lead a different lifestyle compared to Walter. He loves people and talking, but the business of getting adopted is more difficult than it looks because he is feline immunodeficiency virus and feline leukemia. He can't transfer either condition to people or dogs. He's 3 years old and his adoption fee is $45. The shelter is open by appointment. Call 319-362-6288 for more information, and that is from the Cedar Valley Humane Society. And a few more brief Iowa interest stories. A man is robbed outside a gas station in Iowa City. A weekend robbery is under investigation. According to the Iowa City Police news release, officers were called to 1st and Muscatine Avenues at 7:48 p.m. Saturday for a report of a robbery. Officers met with a man who said he'd been approached at Come and Go on Muscatine Avenue by a woman claiming she needed help getting into a nearby residence. Police said the man followed the woman to an alley south of the 2200 block of Muscatine Avenue, where he was pepper sprayed by the woman and then jumped by two men. The man then was robbed, police said. Police said the man had minor injuries. The woman was described as wearing a blue sweatshirt and pink cloth mask. Anyone with information is asked to contact the police department or the Iowa City Area Crime Stoppers. And in Iowa City, related cases of shots fired. Iowa City responded to a pair of shots fired incidents last week that are believed to be related. According to a news release around noon Friday, officers were called to the 3000 block of East Court Street for multiple reports of shots fired. As they were responding, police received additional reports of a second round of gunfire in the 400 block of South Scott Boulevard. Witnesses told police they saw a man get out of a tan sedan and fire multiple times before fleeing. A second man was seen in the 400 block of South Scott Boulevard and was carrying a gun when the shots fired. Police found shell casings and property damage, but no injuries were reported. Again, anyone with information, including security camera footage, is asked to contact the police department or Iowa City Area Crime Stoppers. One final story, burglar arrested in a hit and run. This story is by Trish Mahaffey. A 25-year-old Cedar Rapids man, while awaiting sentencing on a burglary and theft conviction, was arrested Sunday in connection with a hit and run that seriously injured a woman earlier this month and a series of burglaries committed shortly before the crash. Cardell D. Redmond, age 25, is charged with first-degree theft, three counts of third-degree burglary, and multiple traffic offenses in the crash. He was taken into custody around 10 p.m. Sunday in Cedar Rapids. He said Redmond was driving a stolen truck just before 7 a.m. November 9 when he crossed the center line of 33rd Avenue Southwest near 18th Street Southwest and hit a minivan head-on, driven by Haley Weibel, age 34. The woman needed to be extricated from the van, but Redmond was able to flee. Redmond is accused of stealing a truck from Cancun Mexican Grill and Bar at 365 33rd Avenue Southwest between 1 and 3 a.m. that morning. Redmond had tried to escape on a city bus, but officers stopped him and found jewelry, a crowbar, marijuana, and a set of scales in his possession. Redmond already was on 2 years probation in another burglary case when he stole jewelry, court documents show. That does it for the reading of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, December 1. I'm your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
This is Jim Ralston, and I'm with IRIS, Short Take from the Iowa Curiosities. Farmers and their toys, Dyersville, Iowa. The wisdom on bumper stickers is true, and those with the most toys truly do win. then the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville is a winner many times over, with two floors of more than 30,000 farm toys and exhibits, ranging from row after row of common tractors to combines, harvesters, and haulers, all the way down the extensive agricultural machinery lineup to an anhydrous ammonia tanker. The museum is a shrine and miniature to the heavy equipment Iowa farmers fuss over, endlessly fix, periodically live in during planting or harvesting, and tirelessly operate to bring home the grain or the beans that bring home the bacon. And don't let the word toy fool you. The only thing toy-like about these farm toys is that they are built to 1/16th or 1/32nd scale, and don't have internal combustion engines. This is Iowa, after all. Farm machines aren't child's play, even when they're toys. Most of the toys are stunningly accurate, not to mention beautiful. Replicas of tractors or combines with particular makers like John Deere and Case, from particular years, with details accurate down to the windshield wipers. Children play with these toys not only to have fun, they got a vocational education and heavy equipment. Highlights of the museum include an exhibit explaining the notion of scale that features a full-size replica of a John Deere tractor accompanied by a row of successfully smaller scale models, from 1/2 scale all the way down to a realistically looking tractor you can carry in your pocket. Upstairs, look for more tractors and harvesters, enclosed in glass cases, more perhaps than you've ever hoped to see. And though the word toy does technically appear in this museum's name, don't expect much playing around. Tractors, trucks, trailers, and combines, even at 1/32nd or 1/64 scale, are way too wrapped up in Iowa's blood, sweat, and sorrow to be simple objects of play. Don't be surprised if you see some old-timer kicking the tires of a tiny Case combine, wondering how it would hold up harvesting more than 2,000 acres. Or some young, unquietly cussing pocket-sized John Deere because it won't turn over. The National Farm Toy Museum is at the intersection of US 20 and Iowa Highway 136 in Dyersville. Open daily from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., the museum also hosts a number of special events. Exhibits throughout the year, the largest of which is the granddaddy of all farm toy shows, held the first full weekend in November. For more information, call 563-875-2727 or visit www.nationalfarmtoymuseum.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.